Hey there. What happens when an artist realizes that they can never be the only one telling the story? From the Center for the Study of Art and Community, this is Art is Change, a chronicle of art and social change where activists, artists, and cultural organizers share the strategies and skills they need to thrive as creative community leaders. My name is Bill Cleveland. This episode is part of a special Art in Action series produced in partnership with the Charles F. Kettering Foundation's Democracy and the Arts program. In these episodes, we'll be speaking with artists, cultural organizers, and arts leaders who are navigating and challenging current efforts to limit free creative expression and free speech. Together, we'll explore what freedom of expression means in practice, not as an abstract right, but as a lived responsibility at the heart of democratic life. My guest today is the artist Eric Gotzmer. Eric was born in Nashua, New Hampshire in 1976, and by his own account, art was not in the plan. It should have been, though, because when Eric was a kid, he believed he could communicate to future ancestors across time. But he took a different path. As a young man at Duke University, he studied history, literature, and political science. And when he graduated in 1998, he went to work in the office of Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist, a real go-getter, headed, it seemed, toward law or government, certainly not a camera. But then, in 1999, that all changed. Duke's Center for Documentary Studies had a partnership with the international aid organization Save the Children, and they sent Eric to Ethiopia as a photographer. He went, by his own description, naive, curious, and largely unprepared for what he'd found. And what he did find didn't just give him a body of work. It gave him a set of questions about power, authorship, and who a camera really serves. Questions that have shaped everything he's made since, from years of collaborative photography in Addis Ababa to the founding nearly two decades later of the Civic Art Project Four Freedoms. So that's exactly where our conversation begins, with a young photographer, a drought in the Somali region of Ethiopia, and the moment everything he thought he knew about picture making started to come apart. Part one, curiosity and a camera. Eric Gotzmer, welcome to the show. I'd like to jump into your story with that first overseas adventure.
I know that you went to Ethiopia, as you've described, a sort of naive person with a lot of curiosity and an interest in making a difference as a budding photographer. But the project itself turned out to be something way more than just a documentary project of young people in the AIDS crisis.
Could you talk about how and why it changed so much for you?
Yeah, so I was sent as part of an institutional partnership between the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University and an international aid organization called Save the Children, which is one of the largest international aid agencies. And when I got there, again, not knowing much about what I was supposed to be doing, they sent me to photograph a drought in the eastern part of the country in the Somali region, where at the time there were recurring droughts happening. And this was veering into famine, and they wanted me to go out as a photographer to make photographs with a group of doctors. And so we'd drive in a van out into the desert, and we'd find groups of pastoralist people walking their livestock. And when we found people, we'd get out. The doctors would measure everybody's vital statistics and health indicators. And my job was to take photographs of the most starving people that I could find to put into reports that would then go to what was then USAID, which no longer exists. But, and that would trigger an international response to allocate dollars to this very desperate situation of these people. As I was standing over some of the most desperate people in the country, on earth, really, I realized that that whole process that I was involved in worked, and that it was super messed up. Mm. There was something about images that did trigger a whole set of systems to address an urgent need. And yet images circulated within those systems in such a way that it allowed for the creation of that urgent need in the first place. And so there were all these power relationships that I didn't at the time understand, but I just knew something was wrong about how those images were being used and being made. And there was just something wrong and exploitative about that. So that's when I shifted gears. And there had been other photographers, including one of my mentors, Wendy Ewald, who had been working more in collaboration with people as co-authors of photographs rather than in a traditional hierarchical subject photographer relationship. And so when I got back from this trip to the eastern part of the country, to Addis Ababa, at that time I had heard about the AIDS epidemic, which was really prevalent in that moment in Ethiopia in 1999. And that's when I started working in collaboration with people affected by AIDS, both people HIV positive as well as children whose parents had died of AIDS. But rather than me making photographs of them, we were devising situations in which we made photographs together.
Could you talk a little bit about the transition from the behind the camera authority of the photographer to the collaborator, the story revealing collaborator? That's a pretty amazing shift in the moment that you were in as a newcomer, as a stranger, and not even as a veteran photographer. But, and maybe that was part of the deal, is that you were more interested in getting the right story revealed in the right way than just fulfilling your mission, your assignment.
Yeah, I think of two things when you ask that question. One is my mother, who was a first grade teacher. She's no longer a first grade teacher, but she still is a natural teacher. And I remember how she would ask a lot of questions to us as kids. And those questions were moments where she was teaching or where there was opportunity for learning. And much later, I found out that questions are the basis of all art making. And so for me, that shift from being behind the lens to being in community with people who were helping me make pictures, like, that was not that big a shift, actually, because I was never interested in imposing a vision. I was more interested in asking those questions. And the camera became an excuse to do that. And then the other thing that your question makes me think of is there was this kind of strange distance that often, through this kind of code of journalistic ethics, demanded that the photographer remain separate from the subject. Mm. But I'm being generous when I say it comes from journalistic ethics. I think that's sometimes that's the case. I think other times it was the case that photography has been used as an instrument of colonial violence. And so I think there's a certain amount of deprogramming, unlearning, and relearning that has to happen to think about what the possibilities are if the tools of power, which include the camera, are used to undermine the structures of power. And so for me, that's a through line that runs not only through my work in Ethiopia with photography, but up to the current date through my work with Four Freedoms and thinking about how to take some of these instruments of power and use them creatively to shift that power structure.
So one of the things you've said that it seems stems from that experience is that you've never really made an artwork alone by yourself as a solo. There are many artists who collaborate, but that's a stark shift, as you've mentioned. You moved from a traditional behind the camera kind of person to a completely different mode of art making, creations, and storytelling. Could you talk a little bit more about how that shift happened so quickly? Because you took it from there and ran with it.
Yeah, I think it's impossible to make something alone. And I think it's really interesting from an artistic standpoint to imagine what the world might be like if we started thinking about it in that way. We often think of authorship as a valuing of the individual. And it is true that there is a value to the individual voice and to the necessary and urgent expression of ideas that go against communal norms. But I think there's been this false dichotomy between, oh yeah, either it's an individual genius that goes into a studio and emerges with a masterpiece, or it's some kind of community process, right? And I think art history over the last couple of decades has come to understand that, although there's still a cult of individuality reinforced by the art market, reinforced by how artists are lionized and made into icons. But in reality, I can't even conceive of what it would mean for an individual person to make something entirely alone. First of all, we'd never see it because the observation of it itself is an act of community. Second of all, there would be no materials because all materials are co-created, if not by the earth, by other people. And third, all these ideas that we put out are formed through discourse, through conversation, through learning from each other, through learning from each other's failures. So I think it's actually like me moving from behind the camera to in front of the camera was less of a big shift, I think, in my own personal life, because I was never that, I didn't spend that much time behind the camera, honestly. However, collectively, globally, I think making that shift from imagining our achievements as communal and collective rather than individual is the single most important challenge that we as a species are facing.
At every level, absolutely. And I have to imagine that being dropped into a place in which the cooperative collective actions of everybody in a small community in upheaval have such deep and abiding impact on everybody else, because everybody is incredibly codependent in those circumstances. Maybe different than New York City, where you live in an apartment and work in a studio by yourself and you're a solo, you're independent.
It's a good question. I think what we're seeing right now here in the United States is this kind of ultra optimization culture of individual genius or individual achievement or greatness. I don't know, like, where does that valorization of the individual come from? I think it ultimately comes from this moment, a kind of global capitalism that has crept in.
Yep. It's hard to sell a community story. I'm a singer. I'm a musician. I believe the choir is one of the most extraordinary manifestations of human creativity and collective energy. But, you know, when music is manifest in the commercial world, the choir is not at the center of the story. It's usually an individual artist. There's no doubt that it's easier to garner the attention of the audience when Odysseus is at the center of the story, right? But what I'm hearing you say is, number one, that's often not the real story. And number two, if we have the patience and the trust, the collective story will often be much more meaningful and powerful. Does that ring true?
Yeah, and I would also just add to that that it's not only the story of the collective, but it is forms of storytelling that are influenced by multiple voices. It's not that I'm ignoring individual experiences. In fact, those are really important, but the ways that those experiences emerge into story and what they can be when the story is told across people, across generations, across cultures, I think it opens up even more power. I think, for creative work.
Yeah.
Rather than it diluting an individual voice. I mean, for instance, like this project that I've been working on recently in Ethiopia is based on a novel written by Balu Girma, who is a novelist, writer in Ethiopia. It was published in 1983. He was killed for having written it because it was a critique of the communist regime at the time in Ethiopia. So it was very important that his individual voice was foregrounded, right, in that moment. And the way that we tell the story about what that meant and the legacy of his novel through many different artistic voices that I've been collaborating with over the last 15 years, that is also important. So it's not that the subject always has to be only the collective, but rather that the collective has the power to co-create a set of stories, even about an individual or about the collective, that can add up to more than what we already know.
Well, yeah, I've been obsessed with story for my whole life. And one of the aspects of thinking about it is that it's like the roots of a tree. Tree seems singular. It's not. The majesty of a great tree could not have happened without all of the rest of the forest and the wider ecosystem in which it grows. And so you get singularity supporting collectivity. You get collectivity begetting singularity. They're intrinsically connected at all times. I feel like what you're saying is yes and yes. If a story has impact, if it's just his story or her story, then I suppose you could say you might learn something from him or her, or you might be entertained. But if you also go, oh yeah, I know this story, this story is a part of my story, then you're off to the races.
Yeah, yeah. And the experience that I described earlier of my mother encouraging us to ask questions or asking us questions, that kind of dialogue and question asking and inquiry is the thing that I think unlocks new possibilities.
Right.
And to me, that is what we're talking about when we're trying to figure out democracy.
Right? Absolutely.
How we connect to one another, how we are curious about one another. They undergird the principles that led to the laws that govern us.
Yep.
But the things that we talk about are individual rights, or really what's that in service of? Like, what was the innovation that democracy was providing to the world? It was a way of resolving difference in common and with self-correction. Mm-hmm. Like, we are going to fail at this. So we're going to build in elections so that we can keep doing it differently. I guess I'm drawing this connection to asking questions because I think there is a sense of iterative mm-hmm. building over time that is part of what I imagine my work to be and is connected to the work building democracy that people have done for a long time.
And I think one of the things about the commodification of everything is that you think that you've asked a question, received an answer, one and done. No. Because that same question will, in fact, come back again. Some questions are new. Most questions are questions that are building on the continuing, evolving story.
Part 2. For Freedom.
So I'd like to segue to Four Freedoms, which I think, at least in terms of the trajectory that I'm aware of, seems like a pretty interesting leap where the artwork isn't necessarily an object. Sometimes it's a billboard. Sometimes it's a town hall, a conversation, a network, even a political action committee. So when you began to move in that direction, did your definition of what an artist is start to shift or change?
Yeah, definitely. So the jump went from me working on this project in Ethiopia in one neighborhood to me working on similar community-based projects in different communities around the world, throughout the Middle East and Africa and here in the United States and in Northern Canada. And one of the things that I was constantly contending with was we were making projects that in my mind were creative art projects because they were asking like new and deeper questions, like you were saying before. That's what qualified them as art. But the form of them might have been a workshop, or the form of them might have been ephemeral in some way. It might have been a discussion. It may also be a set of photographs or an installation or something like that. So it could fit within traditional artistic forms or not. My friend Hank Wallace Thomas and I were having a conversation in 2014, and he was working in a very different way, but also navigating the relationship between community and art and politics. And so we thought about doing something together. What we ended up doing was creating basically what we thought of as a sort of performance project, which was Four Freedoms. First, it started as a super PAC because we were trying to point to the fact that just a couple of years after Citizens United, that this insane equivalency of speech and money, we're pointing to that.
Right.
By occupying that space of a super PAC. Mm-hmm. But later we evolved into other forms. We had to wind down the super PAC for various reasons. But yes, it was a different kind of project for me because the goal of it was to create civic discourse. That was in common with my other projects. But with my other projects, they were rooted in community in one place. Four Freedoms was very broad. It was broadcasting. We were using the nation as a parameter for the work. We were working in all 50 states. We were using mass media. We were putting billboards, which would be temporary over the course of a month with artists' work on it, where we'd give them a prompt to ask a question to the public. And so we were trying to put artistic discourse and critical thinking into public space, into public conversation. That's very different than working within a very small community to engage all the people in that community. But the similarity is that we were trying to take this process, this creative process, and really use it to spark larger questions in a broader way.
Here are Eric, along with his Four Freedoms partners, Hank Willis Thompson and Claudia Pena, sharing that broader vision at the Skoll World Forum in London in 2024.
As someone said earlier this week, democracy is a story. And we've been working with artists to reimagine that story, to promote a vision of interdependence, one which values the ways we are connected, not the ways that we are disconnected. There are things of value that lie beyond democracy. And that's what we are trying to model.
Most of what we know about past civilizations is through their art. There is no civilization without art. Art and culture are what humanity, as we know it, is founded on. Humanity and art are indivisible. So for that reason, we see that all art is political, and the political is personal. So as artists, we reside in the research lab of the collective subconscious. All good research starts with questions. Those questions lead to answers that design our society through technology, customs, and laws. We believe that good art asks questions and good design answers them. And the quality of the questions dictates the quality of the answers.
How do we bridge binaries?
What's the difference between me and you?
What's the value of that difference?
Where do I end and where do you begin?
And what happens when we realize that I am you? And you are me.
Or that they, who we dislike or do not trust, are us. And that from where they are, we are them. Can we find freedom through nuance?
Who taught you to love?
How do you keep your heart open?
Can we imagine a world where love overrules?
Can we let love quiet fear? James Baldwin once said that the artists struggle for their integrity must be considered the struggle, which is universal, for all human beings to get to become human beings. And these are trying times, but in many ways are no different than any other time. In his prophetic book, 1984, George Orwell wrote, almost 75 years ago, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. The past is present. And contrary to what certain people might have us believe, no one has the market cornered on the future. We're all shareholders."
Indeed. Mm-hmm. Nice.
And so over the last 10 years, we've worked in all 50 states. We've worked with thousands of artists. We've worked with hundreds of institutions to plan different forms of activities. We've done town hall meetings led by artists. We've done hundreds of those, usually around one of the topics related to the four freedoms of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, which were freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. We also did, like I said, billboards where we put artists' voices into public space. We've done exhibitions. We've done artist commissions and public art projects. We've done major convenings, but always with the idea that there was a way that art and artists could build greater and deeper civic engagement, but also with the recognition that already there exists an artistic and cultural infrastructure throughout the United States, which includes institutions, individuals, communities, and already within that creative infrastructure, there was a huge amount of creative activity happening. And so if we could harness that, it would actually enable us to ask bigger questions that we could then ideally shift how people respond to those questions.
So can you give a specific example of one of these projects that had a question that mattered to a community? What I'm interested in is the civic synergy, because you're trying to build some currents and ripples that spread and are sustained.
Yeah. One of the biggest examples that comes out for me, comes to mind, is when we took the Four Freedoms paintings that were made by Norman Rockwell in 1943 in response to FDR's Four Freedoms. And we looked at those and we saw that while they definitely represented the spirit of FDR's Four Freedoms, they were made in 1943. And so the representation in those images was a very limited representation of America and Americans. And so it was mostly white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. There's one an American woman in the upper left corner of one of the images, but they became iconic images that represent, it's the family at the Thanksgiving table. Right. It's the man standing up at the town hall. These are images that became very iconic about what America is. So we assembled a group of a couple hundred artists and activists and different folks that participated in restaging those Four Freedoms pictures. And originally we were thinking, okay, we'll just remake the four images. And what ended up happening is as we were putting them together, we realized, well, how do you represent a Jewish person? How do you represent a Muslim? How do you represent a woman? How do you represent? There are all these questions about how you represent. Or what does representation mean? Yeah. Visually and also more broadly, societally. And so we ended up making about 80 of these images. And they were all different versions of them, very faithful to the formal way that they were made originally. And I credit that to the photographer Emily Shore, who worked really diligently on that, and Wyatt Gallery, as well as Hank Willis Thomas. But I think what happened by putting a different kind of representation into that very recognizable form of Americana, it opened up a lot of questions, some of which people were trying to ask already, but weren't getting traction on. We had one person at a relatively large civil society foundation say, you know, I've funded hundreds of research papers on multiracial democracy, But that one image that you guys made of freedom of worship, which ended up on the cover of Time magazine, he said that makes all the arguments that I've been trying to make through all these, this research and advocacy. So I think the question really was about what is representation? How do we better represent all of us in a democracy? But it opened up all these other questions and other ways that people were able to come to the table, literally, and bring their questions with them.
So it's interesting. The last Art in Action episode in August is about the distortion of the work and mission of the Smithsonian that's taking place as we speak. That whole question of who tells the story? What story? The story? The many stories?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what you just described, I haven't sat in a room with all those images, but the visceral feeling of it reminds me of the choir that I was talking about. All these different voices. And the point I'm trying to make in that Smithsonian essay was, there are things that art making, image, sound, movement, poetry, song, can do to represent these kinds of complex ways of being in a democracy that are so familiar to everybody. They're not foreign things. Often when our debates get translated into the us-them dichotomous push-pull dramas you mentioned, people get forced into a non-understanding mode of being in the world. And I think the opposite happens when, like you said, an image or a song hits you and it's like, boom, yeah, I get this. I'm in this. I'm a part of this. People are emotionally and intellectually stimulated before they get to that place in their brain that wants to separate everything into that right, wrong, left, right way of thinking. So I think what you are doing is thrilling, but I'm afraid that we don't have enough exposure to this kind of work for people to heal the crazy wounds that we're creating for each other in this time.
Part 3, the composite nation.
So your questions about representation ties into my next question. Here we are. Democracyville is under threat. And so Four Freedoms obviously started before this was crazy.
2015.
Yeah. So what can I say? The moment is calling out for this kind of thing. Can you talk about where you see your work going, what's energizing you or challenging you in this moment that we're in?
Yeah. So my studio right now is right across the street from the White House. And Four Freedoms and I are in residence at the Corcoran Boulevard Design at GW, which is literally right across 17th Street from the west entrance of the White House. And so it is very psychically present when there are executive orders attacking some of these cultural practices and artists and museums. But we are also in partnership through that residency working with federal museums. And so I also get to see how all this stuff that we're talking about is so administratively complex, and it's also culturally really complex. In some cases, I feel like it is important that everybody feels represented by these institutions. And also, I find that the kind of tit-for-tat propaganda of, well, if you have this, you can't have this unless we have that, that is missing the point in terms of how art actually operates. I totally am sympathetic to the idea that people don't feel like they have a place in these institutions and that art is considered elitist. I think that is a very fair critique. I don't think the solution is then ban art or make art more reflective of a different set of political values, right?
Most definitely.
You and I have both worked in countries where the nation's story is codified. Here's the story. Don't try to tell another one. And we're not that. And I don't think that will work here. Our culture, the American story, is not leak-proof. It's messy and unruly, and it spreads. If you try and cram it into a nicely defined box with only certain colors and design it into a singular story, it's going to fail. It's going to break. It's going to crack. The real question to me is, how does our navigation of the complexity of our country happen in a way that is compassionate and caring and understanding that there is no perfectly safe space in all this?
Yes, exactly. And also, how is it legible? How do you make it accessible to understand? This is now the artist's challenge, I think. How do you make it accessible to understand stories that may buck what you already know in a way that doesn't alienate somebody and brings them in? Mm-hmm. And that is a very, very hard pedagogical and aesthetic challenge, because I think we're wired to recoil from things that feel alien and different and hard.
Yes. And we live in a world where assertions are preeminent. Questions take the back seat. And I feel like your practice is to front the question. If you're scared, if you're worried, if you're challenged, here's a way to not have to confront a fear with conflict by just segueing into the question that's rising up from you. What is this? Why is this strange thing here? This freaks me out. Why does it freak me out, right? Which is so different from your difference makes you an enemy of some sort, or you're trying to take something away from me.
It takes a lot of care to make people feel comfortable in that
absolutely.
Uncertainty. And I don't think our culture and country has been very good at caring for people that have been kind of left out. And so probably a bigger thing is that the tools that we use to communicate with one another are now engineered for a lack of care and for hyper-individualization, right? But that aside, I think people have really felt alienated and harmed and not cared for. So if something new is brought to somebody that feels like hurt, it's that much harder to be curious about it or embrace it. So part of the work, I think, for us who are making culture is creating the conditions of care that allow people to sit with their own questions.
You know, that question of care has been a through line in many of our conversations here. Derek Goldman and Ariel Fristeau, both of whom are part of this Art in Action series, have emphasized the importance of care. So, Eric, what are you excited about right now in your work?
Right now, we're doing a series of artist commissions over the next few years that's hopefully going to grow into a longer series of artist commissions. But they're really reflecting on a lot of the questions that we've been talking about around American identity through creative projects and through projects that are imagining what I've been referring to as a composite nation, which is an idea I took from Frederick Douglass, where there is form of nationalism that incorporates multiplicity and complexity. One of those projects, for example, that we're working on with Hank Willis Thomas, that's a revision of a project that he worked on a while ago with a group of artists called Question Bridge. We're working on using questions as a way to engage Americans with each other across differences, across the country. And so that is a project I'm super excited about. It is very hard, very complex. Actually, it's very simple, but it's very hard still. So that's a conundrum. But that's something I'm really excited about. I'm also excited about a project that we've been working on with a group of movement organizers called Future Currents, and the artist Mark Bamuthi Joseph, who was most recently at the Kennedy Center. But he has developed six questions that were a reflection on the 250th anniversary of America. And we've been turning that into a series of programs called America the Beautiful. And the questions are questions like, when in your American life have you felt most free? Or if money were light, how much would America have to spend? Mm-hmm. and for whom America the Beautiful? These are the kinds of questions that are open-ended, but really big questions that force us into thinking about our relationship to one another. So we have a performance coming up on October 3rd in Los Angeles that's going to be with the artist Aja Monet and Bamuthi and the hip-hop artist X and DJ Makai and some other artists that we're working with out there. And that's going to be at the Ford Theater. So I'm really excited about that as well.
So is that in any way aligned with the election timing-wise?
We've always done projects in relationship to political elections, but not directly related to them. Mm-hmm. We've never been advocating for one or another. We are very anti-partisan in the sense that we don't believe in partisanship. We believe these divisions are artificial. Mm-hmm. But that said, people get motivated around these moments. And these questions that we're asking are questions that help rethink how people are relating to these moments.
Right.
And so, yes, the timing of October 3rd is important. And just one more thing to mention, I am going to be having a solo show of my work on this Ethiopian author in October.
Oh, great.
At the Corcoran.
Okay.
We'll be sure to include information on that exhibit in our show notes. Thank you so much, Eric, for all that you've shared today.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Bill.
And thank you to our listeners for tuning in. I hope you learned as much as I did. I was particularly struck by Eric's comment that none of the work, the billboards, the town halls, the timing around an election is about picking a side. It's about handing people a better question to sit with while everyone else is shouting answers at them. That refusal to resolve things too quickly runs through everything else he told me. That's something to remember. Art is Change is a production of the Center for the Study of Art and Community. We'd like to thank the Charles F. Kettering Foundation for partnering with us for this Art in Action series. Please know that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the host and guests. They're not the views and opinions of the Charles F. Kettering Foundation. The Foundation's partnership with us for this podcast is not an endorsement of its content. If you're interested in learning more about the Foundation and its Democracy in the Arts program, please visit kettering.org or go to the link in our show notes, which also includes links to the many people, places, events, and publications mentioned in this episode. Thanks also to the Art is Change team. Our theme and soundscape spring forth from the head, heart, and hand of the maestro Judy Munson. Our text editing is by Andre Nebe. Our effects come from freesound.org, and our inspiration comes from the ever-present spirit of Ook 235. So until next time, stay well, do good, and spread the good word.